A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thanks, Kirk. Welcome everyone to the Beacons Group Noon Step Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an open meeting and all are welcome to attend, but we ask that only alcoholics share. If you are new to AA or new to the Beacon Group, we have newcomer liaisons who are available to help. They can be reached via email at bgnewcomers@gmail.com. This email is in the chat for you to write down. AA quote of the day. This can be found in the chat feature to view at any time during the meeting. The quote source will always be from our AA literature. The format of this meeting is that we will have a speaker who will speak for 30 minutes on the step of the day, and then we will automatically split into breakout rooms for small group discussions. Each group has a moderator who will divide the time equally and invite each person to share. Questions are encouraged during the sharing part of the meeting. When you share, please be sure your environment is quiet and free of distractions. Breakout room discussion will end at 12:55, followed by day count, announcement, and the Lord's Prayer. I have asked Jackie to read how it works.
Hi, I'm Jackie, and I am an alcoholic, and this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles.
No.
We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Today we will hear a talk on steps 4 and 5, focusing on the fear in sex. Step four made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5 admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And our speaker today is Ricky D from Philadelphia. Please give a warm welcome to Ricky. Thank you.
What's up, guys? My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me okay? All right, cool. Yeah, my sobriety date is November 29th of 2005, and I have a home group, and I've always been sponsored since day one, coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. But actually, I have three men and one female who, for the last 15 years, I've been completely open, transparent, and honest with. And I've been somewhat sponsorable. My job is to be up here is to be honest, to be very honest with you guys and give an adequate presentation of what the AA program is. And my job here is to talk about step 4 and step 5 as far as the fear inventory and as far as the relationship or sex inventory goes. And what I've discovered is that the sex inventory has very little to do with sex, but everything to do with principles. And how I show up, and more importantly, how I leave a relationship. We always talk about, you know, it's big in Philly that we talk about how we are in a relationship. What about leaving a relationship? And hopefully I'll talk a little bit about that. I only got 30 minutes to share 15 years, well, a lifetime of experience in the last 15 years in the recovery process. There's a line on page 64. Talks about being convinced that self manifests in various ways, which would have defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. So my sponsor sat me down. I'm going to take a look at this. How does self defeat me? That means there's two of me. How does self defeat me? Well, there's three ways: resentments, fear, and harms done to others. That's in a nutshell. And so how is self going to defeat me? It's going to get me resentful. It's going to get me afraid. And it's going to get me to hurt other people. So I feel guilt, shame, and remorse because the alcoholism wants me drinking. If I understand what alcoholism is, alcoholism is in between the drinks. And what the 12 steps do is it treats the behaviors in between the drinks. And hopefully I get down to causes and conditions where there will never be a next drink, because if I understand Alcoholics Anonymous correctly, it's a one day at a time in a row forever program. I don't look at it as one day at a time. Everything happens one day at a time. Conscious contact with God is where that came from. Conscious contact with God one day at a time, because this morning I woke up with a fresh case of alcoholism. Every time I wake up from a nap or from a night's sleep, I wake up and it's on me. I didn't wake up today thinking about you guys. I woke up thinking about me. And what I got to do, and what I need to do to get my job done, and end this meeting, and how am I going to sound? And it's all fear-based stuff. So resentment, it says, is the number one offender. It is not my number one offender today. My number one offender today is fear. What I've come to know is that the 12 steps don't clean our DNA out. A lot of this stuff is hereditary. A lot of this stuff is ingrained inside of me. These defects, I am my father. I am my grandfather. I am my grandfather's father. And that's just how I look at it. But I have a program. My father and my grandfather and his father didn't have a program, nor did my mother. And I can stop that cycle of how we behave in life. That makes any sense. I don't know. So as I went through the resentment inventory, I saw how painfully aware I was of me in your life. And now I'm going to look at fear and see how it was painfully aware of fear in my own life. I thought as a young kid, I was just painfully shy and deeply disturbed. I know that today I'm not. I'm still disturbed, but I'm not painfully shy. I'm scared. And it's hard to admit that to another human being or another man in our fifth step. Let them know how scared I am. They don't measure up to my brother. I'm never going to be what my father wants me to be or what my mother wanted me to be. But it didn't start out with those fears. My sponsor just said, you know, he handed me a paper and a pencil. I was very early sober. I spent 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous working Step Zero beautifully. I don't know if any of you guys are working Step Zero, but that's the time I make my first meeting. And so I actually open up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and start going through the recovery process, because it is a process. Drinking and or not drinking will never be treatment for my alcoholism. Not drinking allows me to recover, but not drinking is not recovery. I learned that the hard way. If that makes any sense to anybody, because people told me to not drink, and I did not, and I not drank for a long time. I didn't get any better, and eventually I would drink again. If that makes any sense. Sorry, just the screen's popping around and it's driving me nuts. So I am not made out for computer stuff. I'm just not built that way. So my sponsor at the resentment inventory, I was about 4 or 5 days sober when I went through this inventory process. I'm not saying that's the right way, the wrong way, the good way, or the bad way. This is just my experience. And you can't argue anybody's experience. I don't argue no one's experiences. Whether they're like mine or not, I don't get to say that. Your experience is your experience. That's a beautiful thing. So he said, what are you afraid of? My sponsor actually sat with me and helped me write a four-step. He didn't throw a notebook at me or a piece of paper and a pencil, said, go write a four-step. I had no idea what I was doing. I'd been in the rooms of AA for 6 years. And working Step Zero got me results of what I had, was a few days sober. And I said, I'm not really afraid of anything. He said, really? And he said, are you afraid of what people think of you? I said, yeah, but isn't everybody? He said, we ain't talking about everybody. We're talking about you. I said, yeah, I guess. He said, put it down. Are you afraid of relapsing? I said, yeah. He said, put it down. And next thing you know, after about 10 minutes of having this talk, because on page 18, it talks about until a conversation can be had, nothing can be accomplished. And I spent 6 years in rooms of AA so afraid, because I had a wall of pride that went up. Like, how do you ask for help and not look like you need it? That's hard, but I perfected that art form. That's an art form. And that kept me sick for 6 years in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this conversation in step one, the steps 4 and 5 is what allowed me to get free. And so next thing you know, I had a bunch of these fears, and it tells us exactly what to do on page 67 and 68 of our book. And I had all these fears, and I could look at every one of them, and I can see that there was no God in any of it. It tells us what causes our fear, self-reliance. It doesn't say listed why we have them. It just said, tells us why we have them. But thank God it does. I rely on myself to manage my own fears. I rely on myself to manage. And fear, my defects allowed me for up until 42 years of my life to manage my defects. What is greed but the fear of not having enough? And that could go for money. It could go for attention, acceptance, and approval. It could go for many other things other than property, prestige, and power. What is lust? Lust is my defense against the lonely lack of intimacy that I don't know how to achieve. So I settle for sex. And when I have friends with benefits or I settle for sex, it always makes me feel bad about myself, which makes for more drinking. So I thought AA was going to take the fun out of my life, and it doesn't. What AA did was it allowed me to be aware of, and over a period of time, stop gravitating towards behaviors that always made me feel bad about myself, which always brought on self-pity and shame and guilt and remorse, which blocks me off from God. And when I say blocked off from God long enough, I will drink again. So I write a four step, not to say I wrote a four step. I write this four step to get down to causes and conditions, because if I don't do this stuff, I drink again. That's just my experience. So we went through the fear inventory, and I saw how afraid I was. And have to admit that to another human being is why I'm probably still here, because I could never admit that I was wrong ever, or I was afraid ever. I think I know stuff. If you're like me, you know stuff. Like, I don't know important stuff. I know stuff like, I'll never get that job. I'll never stay sober. I know so much. I know I'm not even going to ask her out because she won't like me. I'll never amount to anything. I'm never going to be a sponsor. No one's going to like me. I just knew stuff that wasn't true. And if you know stuff like that, there's no reason to trust God or trust AA or trust a sponsor going through this stuff. And I'll tell you what, my last relapse, it beat all that stuff out of me. I didn't know anything. I didn't know nothing. I didn't even know what my life was supposed to look like no more. I didn't come into step two the flowery, frothy, foo-foo way. I came into step two that alcohol beat me so bad, I was willing to take these steps. And my third step looked like I didn't believe in God for a long. I didn't believe in God because at one time I did. And then people in my home group told me to ask God to keep you sober, to thank him at night. And then God did keep me sober for 13 months at one time, but then I drank again. So I didn't think God liked me. Now I'm afraid of God. He don't like me. And little do I know today that it's not God's job to keep me sober. It's my job to serve him through you guys. And that's how I'm still here for 15 years. This is the longest thing I've done against my will my entire life. So we had this prayer. So some of my fears evaporated once I had this awakening and psychic change. I'm no longer afraid to relapse. That was my biggest fear. I'm no longer afraid to relapse. I haven't thought about drinking in over 15 years. That's the miracle here. Not that I'm a miracle. I don't consider myself a miracle. The miracle is, on November 28th of 2005, I met a man who was sent by God, I believe, and that's the gift. And then that sponsor introduced me to you guys so that this gift and this life might have some purpose. I don't know. But I've sat down with a lot of guys over the years, and I believe today I have an answer. I just show guys what I did in this inventory process it's just me relying on me trying to make myself feel better. I can't make myself happy enough or free enough on my own in order to stay away from that first drink. Because fear, how does my ego work? My ego operates by trying to get me back in the driver's seat. So I have to worry about everything. They told me, 99% of the things that you worry about don't come true. So I just said, I'll just worry about everything and nothing bad will happen. And what I did was I will pay the price. Like, for example, in a relationship, I'm so afraid that I'm not good enough through my insecurities. I'm afraid that she's going to leave me. So I will gravitate towards behaviors that will push her away. And then I can say, see, I knew she didn't like me. Some people call it stalking. I'm just trying to protect my investment. And that's how I looked at every relationship. I was so afraid of not measuring up and not being good enough. And how can someone who's like her, like someone like me? Because if you know things that I know about me, you're going to feel the same way about me that I do, and it's not good. So I gravitate towards these behaviors. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy for me. I can do it at work. I'm not going to do a good job, but I'll gravitate toward them behaviors. I won't do a good job. And I'll say, see, I can't do this job. It's too hard. And little did I know that that's not the truth, that with God's help, God will work through me in that moment, and I'll get the job done, whatever that job that my boss needs me to do. And we have a fear prayer. Our fear prayer is on page 68. On page 68. Who knew? I didn't know that. We have a fear prayer. We have one fear prayer, one resentment prayer. We got three relationship prayers. There should probably be about 10 more. I don't know. That seems to be the sticking point for most of my life and my sponsees. So our prayer goes like this. We ask him, capital H, this power that we find in these rooms. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And it doesn't even say what I got to do. So I'm a human doing. But AA taught me I'm a human being. So what's he asking me to do is to be still and trust in him and direct my attention to what he would have me be. Principles: kind, considerate, patient, tolerant, loving. I think that's the miracle that happens here. There's something that happens in the human heart, which is indeed miraculous. There's a softening up of our heart. And this inventory process, I've done multiple inventories with many different people from all over the world. And it taught me how wrong I've been, not only about people, but about God and about AA and about my life. And fear is just a sign that my imagination is going in the wrong direction. Why can't I rewrite the story so there's a good ending? I always rewrite the story where it's a mess. I'm a mess, I'm a fetal position, and I can't get out of bed for 4 days. I've experienced an immense amount of fear. And I don't think that it's fully taken away from us, because I think if God removed my fear once and for all, I wouldn't need you guys. I wouldn't need AA, and I wouldn't need God especially. It's not a fear removal process. Courage does not mean the absence of fear. Courage is walking through the fear when I experience it. You know, two of my biggest fears were getting cancer and having surgery sober. I'm not opposed to opiates. I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not opposed to opiates. And in 30 seconds, both of those fears came true in my life. I was 11 years sober and I was diagnosed with cancer. I was diagnosed with stage 3 testicular cancer. And at my age, it was very rare. I had 4 different kinds of germ cell tumors in my testicles. And I was very sick and I didn't know it. And I wasn't even worried about the testicles. They said, you know, you have cancer, you know, have a seat. It was 5:30 in the morning. I work with heavy machinery. So I just figured that I was bouncing around on the backhoe for about 3 days. I just thought that I got a testicle twisted or it swelled up or something like that. And I was getting ready to go into work, but I said, let me go to the hospital and just check this out because it's not right. And they said, have a seat. And you got a mass. Well, I don't know what a mass is. And I said, what's that mean? And they said, you have cancer and it's spreading fast. And we got to make some decisions. Do you want to have kids? I said, I was in my 50s. I said, I just turned 50, 51 or 52. I said, I don't have any children. I said, no, I guess not. And he said, how fast can you prepare yourself for will and for surgery? I said, what do you mean surgery? So we got to remove your testicles. But now, if you're a man, what does that look like? I don't even know what that means. I'm like, hold on, time out here. What do you mean you're taking, whoa, what does that even mean? And they're like, you want to live or you want to die? And I said, I called another timeout. I paused. We have infinite timeouts here. And I called a timeout. And I walked around the corner in this classroom. I had that robe on with your butt hanging out and the little socks with no slippies on. I got into a classroom. I just hit my knees and I just said, God, I do not know what this means, but this will never change our relationship. This is not your fault. This will never change our relationship between you and AA or anything else. Show me here what to do. And the first voice that came in my head was, says, get back up and go in to see that doctor and let's get down and do this. And then the surgery. I had to go through surgery. And like I said, I'm not really down with taking opiates, but they worked with me. They kept me in the hospital an extra day to wean me off. And I had 5 surgeries and 2 rounds of chemo. I got four months of chemo in one sitting. I was floored. I was blasted. And I'll tell you what, I never experienced sickness like that again. And if I get cancer, if it comes back, I don't even know what I want to do about that. But you guys showed up. I was so afraid that no one cared that I had cancer. I had 2 deathbed speeches written. That's how crazy I was. Like, oh, you know, I had this whole long spiel about just thank AA and all this stuff. It was pitiful. But I didn't know if I was going to live or die for about 2 weeks. And I'll tell you what, they're the most peaceful 2 weeks of my life because absolutely no fear. I don't want to die today, but I'm no longer afraid of it. I watched my mom and dad die, and recently, and it was spiritual. I watched three people pass in my sobriety, and I'll tell you what, it's not what I thought it was, and I know God takes us home. And I'm not afraid. I don't want to. Don't get me wrong, because I'm going to die in a fiery car crash. Like, I don't want that. And my biggest fear is this. I'm going to die alone. I'm going to die alone with nobody around me, the same way my father did. My father just died. He didn't die of COVID. He died of loneliness. And I think that's, if we get down to all the causes and conditions of our fear, I think a lot of us, I'm not saying everybody, I'm saying me, if you had told me that 3 months ago, I told you were crazy. But one of my biggest fears is to die alone with no one else around. And I know today that my sponsors will never let that happen. You know, the fear of being lonely. My God, I wish I was alone a lot. My phone, why I kept pausing the video before the meeting is my sponsors were blowing my phone up. And it's always about a woman. It's never about anything good. It's always about a relationship, some issue in a relationship. And it's funny how that switches, you know, from the phone call switch. When you start sponsoring a guy and he's desperate to do anything, and in about 3 months, the phone call switch from, "Yo, where's this at in the big book? To what meeting are we going to? Where are we going?" to, "She didn't answer my text message." I said, "Well, how long has it been?" 5 minutes. "I know she's with somebody else." I said, "Dude, I'm the same way. If my girlfriend will get back to me in 5 minutes, and it better be about 7 emojis and a couple hearts in there too, then I think she doesn't love me no more," right? And that's all that fear, all that crap in my head that I know that isn't true. It's just my fear going in the wrong direction. I ask God to remove it, and it brings me right back into the present moment, because the alcoholism is, for me, it's a parasite. It doesn't want me in the present moment. And where my alcoholism shows up at the most is in my relationships. Especially the boy-girl love relationship, or whatever people choose to have today, that's where it shows up. You know, I've never been in a healthy relationship up until in my sobriety. Some of them weren't even healthy, because you figure, you know, you wait a couple of years to get in a relationship, and they tell people don't get in a relationship for a year. I sponsor some guys here that look like they should be in a boy band. And you can tell these kids at 22, 23, 25 years old to stay away from women for a year. I could do that, but I'm asking them to do something that they probably can't do. The hormones are doing jumping jacks, and it's a good idea. Don't get in a relationship. All I ask is that I sponsor somebody. Same thing my sponsor asked me. Have a relationship with God first. Make amends to all the women in your life, your mom, your sister, your grandma, everybody, all the women that you devastated in this program or through drinking. Make amends to them first, and then do whatever you want to do, but don't hurt people and don't diminish your usefulness in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I have sponsees that have slept their way through every home group in Philadelphia. Now they have to go to meetings in Jersey and Bucks County. And it's only a matter of time before they drink again, because it only tells us in our book a few times whether we drink, if we do something or we don't do something, we're going to drink again. Six times. Twice it tells us in this fourth step in the inventory. And, you know, it says many of us need an overhaul in our sex conduct, an overhauling, not a change. I needed a complete overhaul because I don't date. I self-esteem. Every girl I ever dated in my life added to my life was like an accessory. It was like a pair of watch or a car, or a pair of shoes. It always made me look better and feel better about myself. It always made me feel better about myself. So I really don't date. I self-esteem. And it tells us some things to do. We look out for dishonesty. Where are we dishonest? On a date with me, or anywhere you meet me, the first 15 minutes that you meet me will be the best Rick that you ever see. And that's it. And that's honesty. That's my honest truth, that on a date, I've been dating a girl for a year, and I've only held the car door open for her once on the first date. And she reminds me of that all the time, more than I need to know. And what happens is an actor will forget his lines. eventually. I try to portray myself as something that I'm not. Like, for example, we started dating. I get paid every 2 weeks. So on payday weekend, oh, we're going to live it up. Then the following weekend, I ghost her because I'm so ashamed to tell her I don't have no more money because I spent it all last week. That and she's wondering why. So I portray myself as this person that has money and I don't. Now, the first thing I told her this in this relationship was the only two things I own in this world is a car and a cat. That's it. I live paycheck to paycheck. I'm paying off my financial amends. I'm taking care of my parents. I'm not lavish. I said, but what I can offer you is honesty. And I guess you bought into that, but I wasn't really honest with myself about a lot of things. I thought I could be in this relationship and I really shouldn't have been. And her patience and her kindliness and her love has allowed me to grow through this without her leaving me because she saw something good in me. And I can look like a really good AA member. When I'm being watched, I can look good. That's why I jail well, I rehab well, I detox well, I recovery house well. When I'm being watched, I will always do good. The minute I'm not being watched, I revert right back to old Rick. And so for the first few months, she kept a close eye on me, as I did her. I don't know if anybody else is like you, get in a relationship. Like last night we were driving and I'm lying. I don't own a house yet, but I'm under contract for my first house. And we're talking about fear. To buy a house in today's market is the worst time in 100 years. And I'm buying a house, of course, you know, and it was it's the most horrible process I've ever been through, other than drinking. It's been horrible. Writing a four step is nothing compared to this. Doing a fifth step has been nothing to compare to this. And where am I at here? I don't know where I'm at with time. I lost the screen. Oh no. 4 minutes. All right. So now I have a house. Now I'm under contract. Hopefully I'm making a settlement in a couple of weeks. And now the fear of insecurity is coming in. Oh my God, am I going to be able to afford this? Because the last 4 years, I've been taking care of my parents. And my parents just passed away. So now my brother's buying the house I'm living in now. And thank God that he's buying this house, keeping it in the family. And I can always come back and have some crazy, because this is the house I pretty much grew up in. And I'd have lived with my parents in forever since I was 17. But I moved back 4 years ago. My mom had a stroke. My dad had a stroke and my mom got dementia. I got the opportunity to take care of them. And making amends of my mom has allowed me to see how I hurt women that I'm not involved with. Has allowed me to not repeat that process. And we have three relationship prayers. And I think I should have some more. I need more of these prayers. But it tells us to have an ideal. I always thought the ideal was for her. The ideal is for me, how I want to show up in a relationship, how a real man is in a relationship. Real men pay child support. Real men don't cheat. And what is cheating? Other than I'm afraid I'm not enough. Right? And through this process and through sponsorship and sponsor men, I found out that while I'm in this relationship, I have everything that I need to not cheat. I don't steal from Home Depot no more. I don't steal time from work no more. I'm not looking for attention, acceptance, and approval anymore because this process has squeezed me through. It squeezed all that crap out of me. And I saw how it wasn't, because living's a business. And if you would have, 15 years ago, if there was a Rick's Depot, like Home Depot, what would I be selling in that store? It would be lies, lust, insecurity, aisle four, free for an hour. It would be a lot of dishonesty, a lot of despicable behavior, a lot of porn, a lot of cheating, aisle seven. Right? And today I know that I'll never stay sober with those behaviors, because if I don't change, my sobriety date will. And I don't know a whole lot, but I've experienced a whole lot here. I know I can't get super sober. In Philadelphia, there are guys who think they're super sober. No such thing as super sober. I can't get so sober that we can't drink again. But but I can get so drunk I can't make it back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm never going to outgrow my humanness, so progress, not perfection, is even redundant, even stupid to even say. I'm never going to outgrow my humanness. I'm a basic human being, alcoholic, and I have a mental illness that wants me dead. It wants me comfortable. It doesn't care how it does it. It'll take me. I have an illness that I can't sweat away, pray away. God will not remove that allergy from me. So if I pick up a drink, I know what's going to happen, but knowing that will never keep me away from a drink. The 12 steps treated those behaviors, got down to causes and conditions where I'm comfortable in sobriety. I don't gravitate towards behaviors that make me feel bad about myself. And I ain't got nothing to do with that. That's called sponsorship and coming to believe in God. I am not sober through God's grace. I am not. God's grace got me to my sobriety date. I am sober today. I'm only in these rooms because of conscious contact with God in step 11. Conscious contact is why I'm still here. Everybody in this world has grace. Whoever's taking their next breath is in God's grace. And if I turn a miracle into an accomplishment, that grace is gone. I didn't accomplish anything here. Alcohol beat me up. I sat down with a sponsor. He took me through this process, and he squeezed enough self out of me to make space for you guys. That's as simple as I can keep it. And I'm never going to get so spiritual my head won't lie to me. There's no arrival point here, but there is departure points where we go through this process, and step 12 is not an arrival point, but a departure from our old life. And what an amazing way of life this is. It's awesome and it's awful all at the same time. And between the amazing and the awful, it's mundane, it's routine and ordinary. And no matter what it's like, I keep doing the same things because this too shall pass. Peace, guys. Thanks for letting me share.